From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The urban designer Michael Colville Anderson loves streets. Or at least he loves what streets used to be. And what they used to be, he says, were democratic spaces. Places where people would wander and gather and chat. Streets, Colville Anderson says, were extensions of our homes. And then something changed. And I'll bet you can guess. The automobile came into the picture, and almost overnight, the perception of streets changed. Colville Anderson is an expert on how humans move around, particularly on bicycles. He goes around the world consulting with cities about how to make them more bicycle-friendly. He joined us to talk about how to design what he calls a life-sized city. Join us after the news.
All right.
My name is Riley McDonald. I'm a local musician. Doug Fabrizio is, he's such a personality. You know, he has such a distinctive laugh, such a distinctive voice, and I love his stutter. I don't know if people like to on air mention his stutter, but I love it. It's so signature to him. And when I'm listening to it, I always know immediately what I'm listening to by that stutter. But he also chooses a lot of topics that you wouldn't expect. He's not just taking normal run-of-the-mill subjects and beating them to death. I'm often very surprised by the things that he tackles. I like a program that can catch me off guard, and that's one of them.
If you're like Riley and find yourself surprised and fascinated by the topics Doug and the Radio West team bring to you each week, we hope you will become a sustainer of KUER and the programming you love. Visit radiowest.org to make your pledge. And thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Colville Anderson is an urban designer. Really, he's a mobility expert. He studies how we humans move from point A to point B. He consults with cities about how to make their streets and spaces easier to move around in, on foot and on bicycle. That's his real focus, bicycles. And in his travels, he often hears this: well, we're not really a bicycle culture around here. We're not like Copenhagen. That's where Colville Anderson lives and where tens of thousands of people commute on bicycles every day in every season of the year. But his answer to that is always something like this: nonsense. Don't think of it as a culture. Think of riding a bicycle as something more ordinary, just a way to get from A to B. Yes, places in certain parts of the country, places like Salt Lake City, don't seem planned for bicycles. But Colville Anderson says everything any city needs to design a more bicycle-friendly environment has already been invented 100 years ago. His point is, we already know how to do this. Michael Colville Anderson explained that his involvement in all of this really came by accident. He didn't train to be an urban designer. One day, he took a photo.
Yeah, November 14th, 2006. I did a lot of street photography. I was going to work at Danish Broadcasting, morning commute in Copenhagen, you know, on my bike like we always do. And, you know, it was just my morning commute. Yeah. And the light had turned green and there's cyclists pushing off on either side of this woman who was just standing there with perfect poise. She hadn't moved yet, which is weird whether you're in a car or on a bike. The light's green and you go. And I went, huh, that was a nice shot in the November light. Yeah. And then off I went. And I just put it onto Flickr later in the day because I had a lot of followers there. And there were Americans who were, you know, going, dude, how does she ride a bike in a skirt? Like, what is up with that? And those boots. And for me in Copenhagen, that was just the weirdest thing I've ever heard. I had no idea what these people were talking about.
Yeah.
But then I started, you know, taking more pictures of elegantly dressed Copenhageners and putting them on Flickr. And people just kept reacting to it. Ended up with me starting a blog in 2007, Copenhagen Cycle Chic. And that just exploded in my face. You know, I had mostly female followers on the blog. And it became like this street style blog. That was like when street style was hot.
Yeah.
And I just sort of hit a niche, you know, people on bikes looking good, dressed well in Copenhagen. And then copycat blogs started showing up. And the fashion industry, they jumped jumped onto this, like within, they're quick, man, within months, you know, all the main fashion brands are doing photo shoots with bikes, you know, with, you know, models standing there next to a bike or riding them or whatever. Fashion brands started producing their own bicycles, the Chanel bicycle for $8,000, you know, which I could buy in Copenhagen for like, you know, $200.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just like, holy, what happened here, man? It was wild. I started becoming curious, why is the world reacting to this? And I started another blog, CopenhagenEyes.com, because I was, you know, as a journalist, I'm going, what's going on with this?
Yeah.
How did Copenhagen get to these levels that everybody's impressed by? So that led to me doing a lot of public speaking, photo exhibitions around the world. And then at some point, you know, a friend of mine said, dude, we need, you know, the world is going to need consultants. And we don't, nobody really has any sort of bicycle planning consultants really dedicated out of Denmark. So I went, huh, okay. So I started a Copenhagenized design company. And, you know, the rest really is history. I was a TV and film director, and, you know, my life morphed into this. So that was a wild ride, you know. And I was born in Canada, actually. I was born in the oil capital, Fort McMurray. So from the tar sands baby to the Danish bicycle ambassador, that's like the weirdest journey, dude.
But it's you've also talked about how you've had this artistic / literary background, and you've ended up here is really interesting. And I was thinking, part of it has to do, it seems like, with something that you've talked about, and that is this affection you have for cities and this affection you have for the idea of streets as not as, you know, prohibitive places where only motorized things go, but as places where humans gather.
I think growing up in Alberta, in Canada, you know, in a big stupid North American city with a donut center, which is deserted at night, and living in it was a pretty cool suburb, but it was a typical American suburb, North American suburb. You know, I think I realized when I started, I left Canada when I was like 21, traveled around the world. I started realizing, you know, that there's other kinds of streets,
yeah.
You know, other cities have done other stuff, not just older cities, but, you know, I just, in the back of my mind, because I never thought about it until I started on this journey that I'm on now. You know, I never looked at streets like that, but I've lived in a lot of cities around the world. And at some point, you know, something just goes click in your head when you start really looking at something for a few years like I've been doing. And you just realize that, man, streets can be beautiful and they're not in many parts of the world. And then you start exploring why that is in the historical aspects. But, you know, discovering, you know, that for 7,000 years since we all, you know, have been living in cities together, you know, since the first guy said, hey, you want to be a neighbor? You know, huh, dude, okay, I got chickens, I got pigs, awesome. You know, and from there, cities growing, you realize that streets were the most democratic spaces in the history of Homo sapiens. You know, before that, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, that was sort of different, you know. But as soon as we started living in cities, it was a democratic space. You know, we did everything in the streets, man. You know, we had small homes in many cities, but so we needed a space, and that was out front.
Yeah.
Talking to the neighbors, you know, not just over the fence, but buying and selling our goods. Everything was done in the streets. The children, that was our playground. I mean, it was you know, we met our partners in the streets and gossiped about everybody. Really, you know, the ultimate democratic space. When you talk, you think about maybe people protesting on a public square. I mean, but, you know, the streets were where everything happened. So I found that absolutely fascinating, and then, you know, got incredibly depressed when I realized how that has changed, and really only since the 1940s and 1950s, after 7,000 years, you know, to becoming this, you know, exclusive domain for automobiles in the public perception.
Yeah. I want to talk about how we got there. Let me get a few things out of the way, though, first, because this is something that you've described as kind of your baseline in terms of how you're thinking about this, and that is that you are not a cyclist. Why is that an important idea?
Saying that I'm not a cyclist is something that I do when I'm in North America or Australia, for that matter. I mean, I don't have to say it at a conference in many European countries, but I find it's really important to start with that because, like, here in Salt Lake City at the Bike Utah Summit, awesome conference, but it's the choir, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of them are gearheads and, you know, with all the fancy, you know, bikes and everything. And, you know, I have to say, hi, yeah, I'm not a cyclist, right? I never will be. I'm just a regular man who happens to use a bicycle to get around. I can't fix a bike. You know, if I'm really, you know, pushed, I can fix a flat. But, you know, in Copenhagen, we have 600 bike shops, literally. So I can just put my bike into a bike shop. But, you know, I just see the bicycle as the ultimate symbol for how we should be developing, or rather redeveloping, our cities, you know, where we want to go with our urban development, especially now with urbanization on the rise.
But when you say that you're not a cyclist, what you're saying is it doesn't have to be this specialized culture. It's, you're thinking of it in more practical terms. It's just a way to get someplace.
cycling is transport. It's been transport since the bicycle was invented 130 years ago. There are people who treat it as a hobby and a sport, and that's awesome. Fine, you know, people need hobbies. But I mean, you know, if, as an effective transport form in cities, nothing beats the bicycle, really, as independent mobility. Public transport is super important as well. But really, I mean, the bicycle is the best thing we've ever invented. You know, it transformed human society more quickly and more effectively than any other invention in human history when it boomed onto the stage, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. What we see now is a veritable bicycle boom, 2.0. We're rediscovering all the stuff that we knew 100 years ago, right? We have short memories as humans. But really, you know, if you look at a city like Copenhagen or Amsterdam and many cities in the world, you know, we don't have bicycle culture. That's something like, you know, you people over here talk about, giving it a name.
Denmark is such a culture for bicycles, but you don't think of it in those terms.
No, I don't go to work and say, hey, did you have a good ride in the bicycle culture today? No, you know, it's just transporting myself, dude. You know, I compare it to, I say that we have vacuum cleaner culture, right? Everybody has a vacuum. We've learned how to use it and we use it, you know, maybe not often enough at my house, but we still use it. You know, we don't give our vacuums names. We don't, you know, dress up for vacuuming or wave at other vacuum cleaning enthusiasts on the street. I've had people literally, when I started the blogs early on, you know, avid cyclists reading the blogs and, wow, I'm digging it. And, you know, get emails saying, hey, do you wave at other cyclists in Copenhagen? And I'm going, you know, and I one day I tried to count all the cyclists that I was with. It was like 10,000 on my – I mean, imagine waving to people all day long. And you know, but, you know, they do that here, and that's awesome because it's a subcultural feeling. You know. But not, in Copenhagen, you don't talk to anybody. You just transport yourself like you would in any other form of transport, right?
But that's where you want to get to, right, is in all places, not thinking of it in specialized terms. This is just how we get around. That's where you want to come to.
The mainstreaming of urban cycling, you know, reestablishing the bicycle as transport. And I always say reestablishing because it used to be normal everywhere, even in this country, is incredibly important. I actually see it, you know, invited here by Bike Utah and in a room at a conference filled with, you know, avid cyclists. You know, I have to say even, you know, it's not very helpful to have subcultures if you're trying to mainstream any idea. So, you know, awesome people. I know them all over the world, all the avid cyclists, you know, and they're super people, but they are a subculture.
Yeah.
And many of them are, you know, trying to protect their subculture. So, oh, you want to ride a bike? Okay, let me give you some lessons. Let me train you to ride a bike. You know, seriously, cyclists don't need training. They just need encouragement and infrastructure, basically. And so that focus on, you know, if you want to be one of us, you have to dress like us. You have to have the same equipment as us. That is really prohibitive to growing cycling as transport. Mm-hmm. You know, all you need is a bike, right? I mean, and infrastructure, hopefully, to ride it on. And so... You know, the nature of subcultures is a bit of a hurdle in many parts of the world. So I always speak to the mainstream aspect. You know, I'm not a cyclist. I never will be. And, you know, the 99% of people who could be on a bicycle, they don't want to be, you know, gearheads and dressed up in
spandex.
They
don't want a kit.
Yeah, totally. You know, they don't want to be – we're conservative. Homo sapiens are very conservative regardless of what political party we may vote for. You know, we just want to live a normal life. We don't want to stick out like a sore thumb, and you do. You know, I often speak about how if a guy's sitting in his car and a cyclist blows past along the curb, you know, wearing all the spandex and gear and some road bike, you know, the guy in the car is going, oh, you know, what a schmuck, you know, damn cyclist. You know, if a guy rides past him in a suit with a briefcase hanging off the back rack, you know, that guy's going to go, huh. Hey, I got a bike in the garage. I got an old Schwinn. Yeah. You know, I could maybe that could be me. It's a societal mirror that we need to put up to people, and that is more helpful to growing cycling than presenting people with uniform.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of where we ended up, where we did, because you've talked a little bit about this. Because you talk about in some ways, as you said, used to be that's how we got from point A to point B. At least a lot of us bicycles. But then it changed overnight, and I wanted you to in relative terms, it changed overnight. The perceptions of the street changed overnight, and part of this is urbanization, but a big part, of course, is the invention of the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what changed there, because you say we stopped seeing streets then, and I guess this makes sense. It's a mechanized thing, so we stopped seeing a street as a human space, and we saw it as a space for something else.
Mm-hmm. It's quite wild to look back on your history here in America and look at when the automobile appeared on the streets of American cities in the 10s and the 20s. You know, cars were detested.
Yeah.
I mean, motorists were despised. You know, there were tens and tens of thousands just of children getting killed by cars. You know, you can imagine, like, if all of a sudden your children were being slaughtered in front of your eyes, you would be kind of irritated about that. And so you could get lynched out of your car almost in many American cities. Monuments were erected to the dead under the wheels of automobiles. Man, there was pushback against the automobile. I often talk about how, you know, with the invention of the automobile came this thing they now call traffic engineering. And when cars appeared, you know, with this rapid urbanization and then the appearance of cars, nobody had a solution to traffic safety, you know, all these people dying.
Yeah.
And so they handed it off to engineers. Who were doing amazing things with these growing cities, but they didn't really know what to do either. So they tackled streets from the word go as puzzles to be solved with mathematical equations like water supply, electricity. Roads became a puzzle, not a human democratic space. The automobile industry hopped onto that happily because they had products to sell, and they started, you know, spinning it and marketing it. And
they were getting a bad name because they were killing lots of people.
Everybody hated their products.
Yeah.
And so if you want to sell them, you got to change that perception. So, I mean, it's, you know, your word here in America for jaywalking, that was the automobile industry who invented this phrase. A jay in the slang of the day was like a country bumpkin.
Like a rube.
Somebody who comes to the city and didn't know how to walk around the busy sidewalks, kind of awkward country bumpkins, you know. The rednecks. And so, you know, jaywalking became, you know, the act of crossing a street in the middle of a block, you know, became socially unacceptable. Boy Scouts were enlisted handing out flyers to people, chastising them for this behavior. It's a 7,000-year-old habit. I need bread. The baker's on the other side of the street. I'm going. No. Now you have to go to the crosswalks, you know. And this sort of, you know, subjugation of society in our cities began. And really, it took 20 years. That's a short amount of time after 7,000 years of cities where all of a sudden, yeah, roads are for cars, man, you know, and I have to wait at the light to cross.
And playgrounds. You've talked about this. Playgrounds in some ways were an invention of this idea of, all right, if kids are getting killed in the street, let's put them somewhere else.
The last great challenge for the automobile industry was the angry mothers of America.
Yeah.
Angry because their kids were dying. Weird, I know. But and really, I mean, the greatest book about this is called Fighting Traffic by Peter D. Norton. I mean, he in a real academic tone, but he really describes this. It's an awesome book to read. It really changes your perception. But, you know, the kids were still dying under the wheels of automobiles. So, hey, let's get the kids off the streets. But where are we going to put them? Let's invent this thing called a playground like we still know today, this little zoological garden into which you throw your kids. So finally, the mothers were appeased, and they went, "Huh, okay, my kid's not going to die. You know, they're going to maybe break their arm falling from a swing, but I can deal with that." You know, and then, you know, really, after that, the stage was set for the greatest paradigm shift in the history of our cities. You know, that perception that we have now, roads are there for cars, and we've been paying the price for that since, you know, the 1940s.
One of the themes of this of your work, it seems, and you sort of have already referred to this, is the as you said that we put engineers on this because we were desperate. Kids are getting killed. Pedestrians are dying. Engineers figure this out. As opposed to, I guess, what we should have done is let's have designers come in. And this is there's a big distinction here. I want you to talk about this. What's the difference between a designer and an engineer in terms of their purpose?
You know, I have designer friends who wear the T-shirts, design can save the world. You know, nah, probably not. But I mean, design is a human process, right? You know, the team that made the smartphone that I have here, they're serving the interests of a multinational corporation who wants to make billions of dollars. But they are thinking about me and my 8-year-old daughter, my 88-year-old dad. They want me to have a good, intuitive, pleasant design experience, you know, using that, you know, the phone or the toaster or the toothbrush, right? It's the people designing stuff, they think about the human on the other end of the process. Engineering is computer models. It is, you know, calculations. And a lot of traffic engineering is based on computer models that were developed in the 1950s and 60s. And we're still just like following them like it's the Bible. It's really mind-blowing. You know, if our education system, our health system was based on the 1950s paradigm, there would be like, what is going on? We would live in a weird place. We still let traffic engineering dictate our streets, and they have failed. You know, what's the goal of traffic engineering? It says trying to get as many cars down a street as possible. If you think about the zillions and zillions of dollars all over the world, you know, globally in the last 100 years that we have spent on roads and motorways and tunneling through mountains because we can, you know, what have we learned from 100 years? One simple fact if you make more space for cars, more cars will come. That is it. That is the sum knowledge of that obscene amount of investment. And we know that 35,000 people a year still die in America on the roads, you know, and because of the engineering standards, you know. So engineering is the great hurdle. And I work with engineers on our projects with cities around the world, you know, and we're seeing a change now. We're seeing a paradigm shift in that profession. But here it is your Rocky Mountains that you have to climb still, you know, this perception of the, you know, traffic engineers know best. And they don't. It's time for them to step aside and solve the problems that we present. We just have to change the question. We have to give them new problems to solve.
Yeah.
With our urbanization, like I said, 100 years we've asked one question of our engineers. How many cars can you fit down the street, right? Improve flow, reduce congestion. Modern cities around the world are now changing that question. They're asking, how many people can we fit down a street? You know, we got growing cities. How many people using all the forms of transport at our disposal, all this cool stuff we've invented? You know, it's pretty cool here in Salt Lake City. You know, you got your trains and whatnot. You know, that is the way to think. You know, a four-lane road, you know, a one lane for cars can only move 1,300 people per hour. You know, a 2.5-yard wide, you know, cycle track, protected bike lane, can move 5,500 people an hour. A tram, 60,000 people a day. You know, a modern street can move 10 times the amount of people down a street than, you know, this car-centric design that we just inherited from a previous century without thinking about. So it's numbers. It's not like, you know, I'm not a cyclist. You know, I don't care if people are going to ride a bike or not. There are a lot of people who could be, and we have to design our cities for them.
One thing you've talked about is what designers do also is they observe the way humans behave. Benjamin Bombard, one of our producers, he was pointing out is called a desire line just outside the building here. And I think he showed it to you, right?
Yep.
So, and it's basically this pathway that's been worn into the golf course, used to be the golf course, to the train stop, to our building. There's no path there. People just sort of created one. Now, explain what's going on there. Because this is what you call a desire line, I guess.
Desire lines are democracy in motion, democracy in movement. It is basically urban democracy. And that is incredibly important when we're trying to rethink city design, urban design. That is an example of people telling the campus here, or if it was in a city, the city, where they want to go. Right. And we have had so much arrogance over the past 60, 70 years with this focus on traffic engineering. And we will tell people where to go and they will go there. You know what? In a city, cities are organic creatures, you know, and the people who inhabit them, they know where they want to go and they tell us. You know, they carve out these desire lines. It's the most beautiful expression in urban planning. I desire to go there and I'm going to do it. And so I've seen a lot of examples here on campus, University of Utah here, and, you know, where the grass is trodden.
Yeah.
There's stupid steps going down, and then there's like a path off to the side where people are riding their bikes down it because you can't ride a bike down steps. So,
right.
You know, so I mean, you know, a modern city will redesign accordingly. And we see this, and this is a growing movement now. We see that people are actually, you know, with their desire lines, they're influencing city design. Like, and we're good at this in Copenhagen, you know. Oh, God.
People. Yeah, but you have to pay attention to that, right?
You have to look. You have to observe.
Yeah.
And this is like the whole, you know, tradition of human observation in the urban environment is something that we're seeing more and more. You know, urban planning in this country, you know, has been at conflict with traffic engineering, where in a lot of European countries, they've actually sort of walked hand in hand, you know, into urban design. So we see urban planning having more of an influence. What we do at my company, we really focus on anthropology and putting anthropology at the top of the pyramid and then planning and design. And then, okay, we need to build stuff. Let's get the engineers into that.
It's Michael Colville-Anderson. He's an urban designer and an urban mobility expert. We have a link to his blog. It's called Copenhagenize on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking to urban mobility expert and designer Michael Colville-Anderson. He was in Utah this week talking about how he wants more people to bike and walk, and not just for their health, but because it's the easiest way to get from point A to point B. And he knows that right now it's probably not the easiest way to get around, but he says with just the right design, the right way of thinking, you can change that. There's this behavioral study that your firm conducted in Copenhagen, which you've talked about, the behavior of people who are riding bicycles. And one of the things you noticed is, and it's interesting, you talk about how motorists sort of gripe about people on bicycles constantly breaking the law and they think they own the thing and whatever. But one thing you noticed is that not many actually did break the law. I mean, when you really came to it, and even those who did, and this is fascinating, even those who did, like there's this picture you have of this guy in a crosswalk, riding his bike in the crosswalk, mm-hmm. which you're not supposed to do.
No.
But the way his posture was, the way he changed his human form seemed to say a lot about sort of human nature. Would you talk about that?
We realized that nobody had really studied cyclist behavior at any point, even when everybody on the planet cycled 100 years ago. Nobody really looked at it. So we pioneered this focus on desire lines, and we filming intersections and studying every single person on a bike. And this intersection you're referring to, there's like 16,631 cyclists an hour, and that's a low-level intersection in Copenhagen.
Wow.
But looking, how are they using this car-centric space? How can we improve it? How can we redesign it instead of just accepting it? And we really noticed that, first of all, when you hear everywhere I go on the planet, oh, those damn cyclists, breaking the law, rogues of the urban landscape. The first thing I say is, you know what, dude, you probably haven't given them intelligent best practice design infrastructure. Even worse, none at all. You can't complain about cyclist behavior until you give them best practice infrastructure. Then we'll talk. I don't want to listen to this until a city has redesigned itself intelligently and modernized with bicycle infrastructure. But we noticed that when people were breaking or rather bending the law, you don't have to be an anthropologist to sort of assume that if you're doing something like unacceptable, socially unacceptable in the public space, you'll probably cover yourself. Like we do when we're embarrassed or we're crying or whatnot. We noticed that people would actually rise up on their bikes, or stand up on their bike. They made themselves larger, more visible to the rest of the herd, as it were. And they looked around at people with kind of a goofy look on their face. They're apologetically, saying, I'm sorry, I'm kind of, bending the laws. Bear with me, I'm almost done. And then they hit the legal zone on the other side of the crosswalk. Boom. And they just assumed the same position and cycled off to work. They were incredibly considerate, right? You see in maybe less bicycle-friendly environments in American cities, cyclists blowing through red lights. Oh, yeah, that's kind of irritating. But there's been studies, like in New York, that cyclists do that in order to keep themselves safe, to protect themselves from right-turning vehicles. So it's kind of a survival instinct more than it is a socially unacceptable behavior.
Because
right?
The city's not designed right for them.
Yeah, in cities where there's been no provision for cyclists with best practice infrastructure, you're it's a jungle out there, right? And you have to – when you're in a jungle, you have different radar. You act differently than you do when you're in your home sort of thing, right? So, it's really important to understand, people, we're all conservative. We don't want to break the law. I don't walk around the streets of Salt Lake City smashing windows for fun, people don't want to break the law, cyclists included, designing a city for them reduces, all of this sort of socially unacceptable behavior. You have like hundreds of people on bicycles at every light cycle in Copenhagen in the morning rush hour. They just sort of sit there waiting for the light to turn green, right? Because they are safe. They know that light will be changed in a minute. They'll still get there faster than anybody else. So you can improve human behavior on bicycles if you provide the best practice infrastructure.
What are you noticing? I want to talk about particular bike lanes in Salt Lake City as an example of this. But generally, how are we doing at designing bike lanes in this country?
In this country?
Yes.
Oh, my God. I heard a great quote yesterday from Winston Churchill that you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else, right? This is a really good quote. And it really is the case here. You see a lot of American cities trying to reinvent the wheel, but the wheel's round and it's been rolling for 130 years. The Shero. I got to talk about the Shero because I'm here and I'm close to Denver where they actually invented it. Oh, my God. The Shero is going to change everything for cycling in America.
Explain what the Shero is for people who don't know.
The Shero is simply a pictogram. You see it in a lot of cities around America. It's just a bicycle with sort of two arrows on top of it, sort of a shared arrow.
Yeah.
And that's not providing infrastructure with bikes, but just painting a pictogram saying, oh, bikes can cycle here, still not separated from the automobile traffic, right? We know now that they don't work and they don't encourage people to cycle and they actually reduce safety for cyclists. But still, this was like the great American invention, the Shero. And it really didn't take very long to realize that it was a flop. The design in many cities here where you put the bike lane on the left side of parked cars, that it's quite possibly the stupidest place to put a bike lane in history, between the door zone of a single occupant car society and moving traffic. You know, putting these squishy obstacles in there is a great way to protect the paint job on parked cars.
Right.
That's about the only function it has. So we know that that's stupid. For 100 years, we've known how to build bicycle infrastructure. And for 100 years, all we've done in countries like Denmark and the Netherlands and Germany is test it with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, you know, in the last century. So we know what works. Best practice has been established.
What works?
In Denmark, a design nation, but if you know we have designed it so well in 100 years, there's only four types of infrastructure for bikes. You know, you go across America and you're seeing like 50, and none of it is very intuitive. Best practice design, you know, if you have a slow speed street, you know, the speed limit's 20 miles an hour or something, you know, 15, 20 miles an hour, you don't need to have infrastructure, right? You can just sort of share the residential road. You know, everybody sort of figures that out.
Yeah.
When the speed limit hits, I think, 30 miles an hour, okay, now it's time to start separating the cyclists. So a wide painted lane, 2.5 yards is the standard in many European countries, one way for, along the sidewalk. Speed limit hits like, 40 miles per hour, cars start speeding up. Then you start physically separating with a curb or with barriers or whatnot. You know, you get the cyclists away from the moving traffic. You get up to freeway speeds. You know, you don't put bikes anywhere near cars moving that speed. So riding around American cities, and I've done that a lot. I mean, you know, it's amazing. You're next to like, you know, semi-trailers, you know, with hardly any space. So we know what works and it's been tested. It boggles my mind that something perfect has been developed and generations of planners and engineers in Europe have actually figured out the best possible solution. And why cities are not just copy-pasting that, control V, control C, into their cities, beyond me. Other cities are doing it. They're just copy-pasting because they know it works. America, you still have that not invented here mentality.
That's the resistance. Kind of cultural.
It's we're America. Yeah. Man, what an amazing country. You know, so many things that have been invented here. And, you know, thank you for all of these amazing things, America, while I'm here. You know, but, you know, leave bike infrastructure alone and just be proud enough to put them back. So everything's been invented already. And you guys were so close in the 1960s and 70s to establishing best practice design for bicycles. And then the engineering, you know, monster kind of dominated and took over and all of that was sort of pushed out of the way and forgotten under the rug. Now we're returning to that, and now it's permanent. It's not going anywhere this time. We know that, right? With all the challenges we face in our cities. So
let's talk about. We actually printed a couple of photo images of Third South. This is Broadway in Salt Lake City, and there's the city not so long ago sort of redesigned this street. Mm-hmm. The idea was to make it bicycle friendly, and it's caused a lot of consternation here. And we've had you look at it. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what's good, what's bad about Third South in terms of the way we're thinking of bicycles.
Well, you've given me like two different photos of the same street, two different stretches. So the one that I'm looking at is about as close to best practice as you get. You have a curb buffer between, you know, separating the cyclists from the moving traffic.
Yeah.
They have their own space. It's nice and wide as well. You know, that's probably about 2.5 yards wide. That is pretty close to best practice. Best practice would be that you asphalted that and you had a curb down to the cars and a curb up to the pedestrians, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But this is really...
Because to really define that separation.
Yeah. You know, it's a hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
Pedestrians have their own space, a sidewalk, right? And roads, cars have, you know, car lanes.
And so you need to give bicycles their own space too.
One of the fundamental challenges in this country is that for a long time, you've just sort of put bicycles in the same box as cars. So they're kind of like vehicles. They move quick. Well, just put them over there. And successful cycling nations and we put bicycles over with the pedestrians. They're just fast moving pedestrians. They're vulnerable traffic users. That's a group that hang out together. Cars are a completely different species. So that's an interesting difference. And that's something that's changing slowly here. But that, you know, this is best practice. Then it morphs into another stretch of the road where I can see that you put the bike lane on the wrong side of the parked cars. It's still nice and wide. There's a bit of a buffer for the door zone for cars and stuff. But, you know, I don't know why that just wasn't continued the entire stretch. So Salt Lake is – I've been cycling around here and it's a – I don't know. My jury's out because it's an interesting city of contrasts. You know, you have really good infrastructure on some stretches and then just like some real, you know, brain farts on other parts of the city, right?
Right.
And then you come to the university campus here, and it's like they've invented the time machine here. You know, you morph back to 1952 on this campus. You know, there's some good people trying to influence the university. It is just the most car-centric campus that I think I've ever seen. It's bizarre. In a city that's actually making some effort, the campus, this place where good ideas should be, you know, formed, and the young people who go here should be influenced positively on how cities can be better. It's like parking lot with some buildings in between, right? I was really, really disappointed to cycle around the campus here, despite some of the good things that have been done. But still, like the big picture, it sucks. But so, yeah, it's a weird contrast, Salt Lake. I like it here. It's an awesome place, great people. But, you know, they're doing good things and then they're kind of not doing good things. And, you know, you gotta choose where you want to go.
You know, it kind of raises a big question, and that is, are Americans ready for a paradigm shift? It seems like you think they are, but I'm wondering if in places, and I think that maybe this is unfair to say, but I think there's some sense in Western places that really were car-centric from the get-go almost, seems, at least that's the sense, like that back east there was more thinking about the way they designed their places around pedestrians, around people, less of that in the West for some whatever reason. Are you seeing any distinction like that?
I mean, again, yeah, I can see how that perception is there. You know, I mean, I think Phoenix is the example that everybody uses as the worst case ever on the planet, you know. You know, and so, yeah, of course, you see this city here with super wide streets and whatnot. I mean, but then, you know, I've heard that Salt Lake had an amazing tram system back in the day, like a massive tram system, and like a lot of American cities did. Yeah. So there was a thought about how to move people efficiently and effectively and intelligently around the city. Bicycles were a primary transport form as well in America. So it's not – we're not trying to, you know, sell you something weird and new that we just invented. We're just returning to something. 100 years ago, the modal share, you know, how many people were on bicycles in Los Angeles was 20% of the population were riding bikes in L.A., right? Look what happened then, right? But I mean, every city – this was a bicycle-friendly city. Every city was. So we're just going back to a place and we're thinking differently about it. But are Americans ready for a paradigm shift? You know, last time I checked, you're Homo sapiens. They're like the rest of us, right? So I mean, all we want is a fast A to B. And if we start planning in intelligently and designing intelligently, I think, you know, any Homo sapiens is going to get behind it, really. There's a lot of examples, you know. Oh, Copenhagen, we all talk about that, you know. But there are cities that where there were no bikes left 5 years ago, and now they are well on their way to becoming bicycle-friendly. Cities like Seville in Spain. Oh, it's too hot to ride a bike there, man. It's 110 in the summer. You can't ride there. Oh, yeah, right. They went from 0.2 on bikes to 7 in only 4 years. Buenos Aires is the new poster child. You know, they put in 100 miles of bicycle infrastructure in 2 years, and it's just exploding, you know. And American cities as well. You know, New York is trying to do some good stuff. Minneapolis is ranked as really, you know, one of the best bicycle cities in America. Minneapolis, of all places, right? So we can see that.
Which is freezing in the winter.
Totally.
Which kind of gets to – and you talk a lot about busting some of these myths. And people say that. It's like, look, it's too hilly for us to ride our bikes here. It's too damn cold in the winter for us to ride our bikes. It's too hot in the summer. People – we're not – you're not – Copenhagen's different for some reason. They're not going to do it. It's cold in Copenhagen.
Mm.
So that idea that it's too cold to ride a bike, that's just – you see that as just kind of a myth or something.
I mean – It's societal, you know. I call it climophobia. You know, I was working in Bangkok, right? And you know, the Thai people have lived there for a very long time, and we were being shepherded, you know, driven around in a air conditioned minivan, and our hosts, who were from Bangkok, every time we had to step out into the heat and then back into air conditioning. Oh my God, it's so hot. Oh my God, thank goodness we're in air conditioning. And I'm going, like, your people have, like, you know, populated this place for 10,000 years, and now it's like a bit warm. And it's the same here. You know, we're used to, we go into our, out of our homes, into our, you know, heated garage, sit in a heated car, into a heated parking, into a heated office. Like, you know, oh my God, we're afraid of the weather all of a sudden after like 200,000 years of Homo sapiens, right? You know, so that is a bit of a challenge. If I had a dollar for every time I had to bust myths, man, I would, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be in the Bahamas, dude. You know, it's amazing. You know, for every time somebody says, "Oh, we can't ride here; it's too cold," I can point to, like, you know, 10 cities that do it. There's like Oslo. It's like kind of my second home at the moment. Loads of hills, worse than Salt Lake. Hard winters, right? And you know, they have 8%. They're still they're kind of, you know, behind the curve, but they have 8% of the population riding bikes every day. You know, cities in Finland with like permanent snow in the wintertime, you got 14% riding bike. You know, there's hilly cities. Yeah, you know, Tokyo is a hilly city. They got in Tokyo, mega city on the planet, they got 15% of the population riding bikes. You know, for every time somebody says, dude, you can't do it there, there's a city that's just completely proving you wrong. And then you remember that everybody used to ride bikes, you know, in all of these cities. So it's just this perception. We have short memories.
Perception, culture. One of the things you talk about, we don't need to spend too much time with it, or we could go off and spend hours talking about it, is this culture of fear. And this gets to something that you've written about, talked about, and that is helmets. Now, your sense, which is that people should not be wearing helmets. Do you want to say something briefly about this? Because this gets to this sort of what you call this pornographic obsession with safety equipment, which is, again, and just I think we're overthinking it sometimes.
I have a TED talk about the culture of fear related to bicycle helmets, which is maybe more eloquent than me here today in the last few minutes
of
the conversation.
We'll put a link to it, by the way, on our website.
Cool. I mean, you know, if somebody wears a helmet on a bike, if that keeps them on a bike, that's awesome. If somebody doesn't have a helmet on a bike, but that keeps them on a bike, that is awesome too. The health benefits of regular people on a bicycle going to work are 20 times greater than any risk, even in a less bicycle-friendly environment like a lot of American cities. It's all about, you know, increasing public health and, you know, making cities better places to live. We have the most amazing tool ever created for doing that. That is the bicycle. We see a bit of a problem in like the bicycle. The avid cyclists who are all geared up and whatnot, they do a lot of the talking and and promoting helmets, as a part of the uniform. There's only 10% of the cycling population on the planet who wear them. Most of them are in the United States. You know, you have all the big helmet manufacturers here, $6 billion a year industry. It's a lot of it is follow the money, you know, and there's a lot of misconceptions about the science of helmets, the industrial design of a helmet. I don't care what people do regarding helmets. I just want them to be able to make an intelligent choice. They don't have that opportunity in a lot of countries, and certainly not this one. It's all emotional propaganda. It's all like, oh my God, wear a helmet. You see somebody, a cyclist get hit. Was he wearing a helmet? Okay, he broke his leg, dude. Like seriously, like right. You know, or whatever, right? And it was the motorist was at fault. You know, I mean, there's a pro racer, Chris Boardman, from the UK, former world champion, and he's now one of the leading bike advocates in the UK. And he says helmets aren't even in the top 10 of the things that we can do to keep cyclists safe, you know. We're in a different environment in Europe. You know, we have it from the highest level of European government that we should not even promote helmets. We should leave that up to the shopkeepers and the producers. You know, scaring people off of bikes is counterproductive to improving city life and public health.
It did scare people off bikes, promoting helmets in Copenhagen. You talk about from 2007 to 2008, the numbers went down and they haven't really recovered.
They have actually now recovered. Because the promotion stopped, like they kind of just let it fade away. So every time somebody promotes a helmet law, you know, and says, hey, we should have legislation here in this state or this county, the great boogeyman is Australia, who have had helmet laws since the 90s, completely killed off all, you know, utility cycling culture. They have all their spandex, you know, boys and girls. That's great. But like no kids ride to school anymore. They just took the culture of fear and embraced it and really killed off so many benefits of cycling. You know, they just put a bullet in its head. And so now that's like, you know, that's the example we all fear is like, oh my God, we're going to be like Australia if we legislate helmets, you know. Do what you want, you know, wear a helmet or not. I don't care. It should not be legislated and people should have the opportunity to make an intelligent, informed decision, and they're not getting that at the moment.
Let's come back to your sense, or your hope anyway, that there's a paradigm shift that's going on, even in the United States. The goal you've talked about is the life-sized city. And there's this sort of lovely sentiment that you've talked about. Your daughter asks you this, what seems like this kind of profound question. So let me ask you this finally. She says to you, Daddy, when will my city fit me? And you said that really got you thinking. And it seems like that's kind of the question, right? That we need to be sort of working through as we consider whether we're going to have this shift?
I mean, we're walking down the street holding hands, waiting across the street. And, you know, she was a little kid. So, you know, the whole urban environment felt incredibly big. So, yeah, she was just like, when's my city going to fit me? But, yeah, I'm thinking, doesn't my city fit me?
Yeah.
You know, and there's parts of Copenhagen. I'm going, yeah, I am the king of this city. You know, I'm on a 5-yard wide one-way cycle track with 42,000 people a day owning it, right? That city was made. They thought about me. It fits me perfectly. Other parts of my own city, no. This city, some places, bits and pieces perhaps, but still, no, most cities in the world. You know, we should just have the opportunity to design our cities for everybody who lives there, to give them that sense that the city was that the city fits them, right? Be it a 5-year-old kid or an 85-year-old woman or man, right? I mean, we are so obsessed with overcomplication and over-engineering and everything. We're not thinking about the human aspect of our cities. And that starts with the streets, you know. A nice shopping mall with some, you know, fake fountains or whatever. But I mean, it starts with the streets. It starts with the transport. From there, we start going back to the future. We start to return to this very important paradigm shift. And it's happening. We hear people around the world, the mayor of Paris for 12 years, of all places. I've lived there. Nobody would have ever thought it was bicycle friendly. He said, the fact is that automobiles no longer have a place in the big cities of our time. Profound for maybe on this side of the pond. But Bloomberg in New York, he said, the streets aren't there for cars. They're for people to move around on bikes, on public transport, on foot. We see a lot of people like that saying stuff like that. And so we know that this is happening. You know, and cities have to just start, you know, getting moving with it. You know, Salt Lake City, you know, somebody's going to overtake Salt Lake City in, you know, in 2 seconds flat. It's, you know, Salt Lake City has the opportunity to be like really one of the best bicycle cities in America. You have so many low hanging fruits here. It really, it's a race now, you know, to modernize our cities, providing infrastructure for bicycles and just making more life size cities.
Michael Colville Anderson. He's an urban designer and an urban mobility expert. We have links to his blog. It's called Copenhagenize on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Sophie Sirois is our intern. Josh Weathers is a producer of Video West. Our thanks, as always, to Susan Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.